Welcome to Your True North, a program that explores how values act as a compass, directing our lives and work. Inspiring guests tell how key events and influential figures shaped their values and how they've used those values to create a life rich in meaning, accomplishments, and personal satisfaction. Your True North is hosted by Cindy Camp. Are you seeking your true north? Then welcome.
Today on Your True North, I'm talking with Brendan Kiley. He's the New York Times best-selling author of All American Boys, written with Jason Reynolds, and the novels Tradition, The Last True Love Story, and The Gospel of Winter. His work has been published in more than 10 languages and has received a Coretta Scott King Author Honor Award, the Walter Dean Myers Award, and the Amelia Elizabeth Walden Award. His work was twice selected for the American Library Association's Best Fiction for Young Adults. He's on the faculty of the Solstice Master of Fine Arts program at Pine Manor College. Originally from the Boston area, he now lives with his wife in New York City. Welcome to Your True North, Brendan Kiley.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Well, I want to start out talking about your work as a writer, and I know that you've used a social justice lens to look at the world. How old were you when you started to think about the world through that lens, and what experiences made you realize that you cared about the welfare of others who are typically pushed to the margins of our society?
I really appreciate your question because I think that my writing self, my teaching self, as someone who was an educator and is still an educator, and also I think in some sense the core of who I am and who I was raised to be are all in line with each other in some way or related to each other in some way. And social justice has been a part of my life since I was young. In fact, slightly humorous. I remember being part of a school walkout when I was in middle school, as we were supporting teachers and their need for a raise. So I think it's always been in my blood in some way or another.
Even since middle school, so say 13, 14. That's okay. That's pretty
exactly.
Early. Yeah.
That's right. Though I'm not sure if it was just the teachers who were using us or not.
You never know. But hey, it's still being on the side of people who need support, right?
Exactly. But I appreciate the way that you frame this too, because you also mentioned about thinking about people on the margins, and I this sounds so simple, but I can hear my mother's wisdom in the back of my head always, in a sense of thinking about how you want to be treated. And I remember feeling so terribly guilty when I was a child, again in middle school, because I was someone who made someone else feel left out. And I remember thinking about how painful it must be to be the person who was acting as the excluder. And I remember my mother always saying things like, you know, simple things like treat people like you want to be treated. And that concept, when you give it the ripple effect that it deserves, I think it has to be a question as we mature to think about questions of equity in our society. There's no way that I want to be marginalized, and there's no way that I want to be part of a society that is marginalizing others. And yet that's the society I live in. And so therefore, if I actually believe in the principles that I say I believe in, I have to work to do something about it. And for me, I try to do that work in my literature. I try to do that work as an educator. And I try to do that work in my everyday life the best that I can. And I think that the only way to do this work is not to think about how you're reaching out to help others on the margin, but rather that you're working in conjunction with those who have been underserved, because they don't need me to go in there and save them. It's rather, I think, an effect of us working together is what actually creates the equity in the first place.
Yeah, I appreciate that point of view. And, you know, it really resonates with me when you talk about your mother's example and the way that she really encouraged you, not just as sort of a, yes, we talk about these things, but that she really wanted you to put it into practice in your life. That's so often the difference. For those who I think, get this, and those who maybe talk the talk but don't put it into practice. And I know today we use this term white privilege a lot, but mm-hmm. I'm wondering, when you were younger, say high school or college age, would you have recognized your privilege as a white male?
Well, that's a great question, because I think it's a lesson that I'm continually learning. I think part of the understanding of privilege is that my way into knowing about this is, on some level, purely intellectual. And I have to begin to do the work to remove it from the intellectual space and really pull it into the gut. And what do I mean by that? I mean that when I was a kid, when I was in high school, for example, I was really interested in trying to help the homeless. And I remember one time having a conversation with my father, and this is what I said. I said, you know, and I was full of good intention. I said, "So, Dad, guess what? This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go be homeless for a couple of days, and then I'm going to come back having understood what it means to be homeless, and then I can do a better job helping the homeless, right?" And my father, you know, I can only imagine what was going through his mind at that moment, like, "You moron." But really, what he said to me was, "Brendan, listen to what you said. You said you were going to go be homeless and then come home. You have no understanding of what it really means to be homeless." And he said to me, this is where it comes to privilege, "That would be like you saying you could go be black for a day and know what that means. And you can't. You can never know what it means to be a black man in America." And I think that though I didn't have the framework and the language to talk about privilege, that sat with me in a way that made me begin to think about how our socialized experience creates a framework for our understanding and on the deepest levels of who we are. And so as I grew older, instead of reflecting on only on what people lack or how people are underserved or how people are marginalized, I had to reflect on the fact that you don't have a marginalized group of folks unless you have people who are also unequally prioritized, meaning privileged in some way. And so it felt to me like the work that I had to do was to reflect on my privilege and begin to work on the identity of someone who has unfairly, unjustly benefited from the racist system that organizes our society.
Yeah, and I love your point of view that in order for one person to have this sort of status as an outsider, as someone who's been pushed aside, someone else is getting extra. Because that's a huge realization. And I also hear you saying, I mean, it sounds like just as a young person really had a heart for others, and especially people who struggled, but you also had parents who were able to help guide you in your growing consciousness about that.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate, and I had friends too, and I had teachers, and I feel very fortunate that I grew up with a network that really helped me think about how compassion should be the action that hopefully is motivating the way that I behave in the world.
There was a gentleman here in Grand Rapids, Michigan recently who did a lecture. He's African American and he's been an astronaut, among other things. He talked about how he remembers the Curious George books and the man with the yellow hat being this, you know, sort of person who saved George over and over again. And it's sort of just a, you know, a set of kids' stories. But his observation was that those of us who are fortunate have had those people in yellow hats to help guide us along the way. Parents, teachers, older friends, people could really help us. And I just love the image of that sort of the man in the yellow hat who comes along, because some people don't get that. Some people don't have somebody coming along to really help guide them. And so I think, yes, as you're saying, that was a key part of your development as a younger person. I know one of your early career aspirations was becoming a rap musician, and I'm wondering what drew you to rap as a, you know, kind of a white kid growing up in Boston. What was your interest?
I can't believe you've dug out that truth. That's one to regret. No.
Well, it's interesting. Tells us
absolutely.
A lot about you. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, it's, I mean, part of it is, I mean, so part of it is the dynamic of how I grew up and where I grew up and when I grew up. So rap music was becoming the most popular music in the world at the time when I was growing up, which is in the 90s. And growing up outside of Boston, there was, you know, there was a, it was one of the kind of cliques and groups you could become a part of when you were a young person. And when I was in middle school, in fact, I used to listen to a lot of rap. And a lot of the rap, frankly, had politically, socially conscious lyrics. You listen to Public Enemy, you listen to NWA, you listen to Redman and KRS-One. And these are the folks that I was listening to when I was young. And listening to those lyrics were an education in people who were speaking up about the iniquity in society around them. So it was exciting music, but it also was stimulating from a social consciousness perspective. So I liked rap because I liked the idea of being someone who had a voice who could shout out to the world and say, why do we accept these wrongs as normal? Why do we accept these wrongs as the way things are? I liked that idea of joining a group of people who were shouting out against those injustices. And that's what rap music really was for me. And then I was writing my own rap.
Good for you.
Trying to perform them at, you know, social gatherings with friends. And you know, I wasn't as skilled in that as I maybe thought I was. But what was interesting is, again, going back to the kind of support network, is that my father heard me and was interested in why I was interested in the music. Because, again, at the time, a lot of people would say, oh, you know, people shouldn't be listening to NWA. They shouldn't be listening to, they found the music threatening. But my father, in his wisdom and compassion, said, you know, Brendan, this reminds me of some poetry that I really liked when I was your age. And he handed me a copy of Allen Ginsberg's Howl. Mm. And for me, it became a kind of exciting new way to look at the literature that I was usually bored with in school and think about it from a new perspective and think about how, hey, you know, that's true. There probably was a whole host of people in an earlier generation who were saying some of the similar things, but about their time and place. And you know what? There probably was a group before them as well. And how cool. Look at Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau and what they're talking about. And it, you know, and it that became a sort of education for me in a way that was much more stimulating than what I was getting in class, because my father found a way to make literature feel as real and palpable with its social justice missions as I heard in rap music.
Yeah, and as you're saying, I mean, the way that the generations can speak to each other, and all of a sudden you realize mm-hmm. it's an ongoing conversation, whether of poetry, of literature, of philosophy. You know, I know, of course, you've built a career as a writer, but I know you've done a few things between the time you were in college and today. And I'm wondering if you'd just talk a little bit about what other work you've done.
No problem. My first job started when I was 10 years old. I was a paperboy for the Boston Globe.
Ah.
And wandering around the neighborhood, you know, listening to music and delivering the news. But I really have been working since then. I worked in ice cream shops, et cetera, et cetera. But after I graduated from college, I moved to New York City to work in book publishing. And I worked a variety of jobs in book publishing for almost 6 years, working for a literary agent, working at two different publishing houses, primarily working in marketing. And I was growing disillusioned with commercial publishing and growing disillusioned because I really wanted to be writing. And by the end of my time in publishing, I was working 14 hours a day for a marketing department, and I just had to leave. So what I did, I thought, you know, naturally, I'll just go write the great American novel in 3 months, no problem. Quickly realized how stupid an idea that was, and I started catering. And I catered in New York City for years while I was, I then went back to school to get a master's in fine arts, and I was catering the whole time, and it was in and of itself a wonderful education in what it takes to be committed to be an artist. Because everybody that I worked with in catering was a dancer, a singer, an actor, a writer, a playwright. We were all hustling to do our artistic work, and we were all hustling to make a buck to pay rent. And it was thrilling to be, again, to be a part of this group of people who, to use a phrase of our time, I think, who kind of lived on aspiration and not desperation. And that was really inspiring. And so catering became a big part of my life. Now, after I got my master's, that's when I was working part-time at a school just to do some other office work and make some more money. I was able to then move into education, and I became a high school teacher, and I taught 10th grade English at a private school in New York. And I also taught night classes at City College, and I was doing all of this. And I don't know when I or anyone else slept, but we did it all.
Yeah, that's a really very full career already, and you're not that old, but it sounds like you've done a lot of things. And I love the story about catering, because especially in places like New York or LA, I would imagine, yes, you're going to run into all kinds of people who are doing this as a way to maybe get into some other area of work, who want to become writers or actors. So what a great environment to be working in.
It really was, and I'll just share this one anecdote, because I feel it, for any of the listeners out there who may be curious about this, it was because of catering that I really found the first scene of my first novel. I knew what I was writing about. I had written scenes that take place later in the book, but I really couldn't find a way into the beginning of the book. And in fact, I never can find ways into the beginning of the book. I find beginnings to be the hardest thing to write. Mm-hmm. But I was the bartender for a Christmas Eve party at a really wealthy family's home in Greenwich, Connecticut. And a few kids squeezed through the crowd to come towards the bar and try to talk me into giving them vodka sodas. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly, it just sort of hit me as they squeezed through the crowd that these were the kids that were going to open up the book for me. And so, partly it was, I think, that I was around all these artists and I was sort of, the door was always open for inspiration. But also, I think we have to be open as often as we can, because we never know when these great ideas are going to hit us. And I wouldn't have found this if I hadn't been catering.
Yeah, well, that's a great story. And it certainly, again, exemplifies the sort of, I guess, rare air in some of the places that you found yourself. So catering in a wealthy family's home in Greenwich, Connecticut, teaching in a private school in New York City.
Yeah.
So let's shift gears for a minute, because, as you know, Your True North is a program about how highly principled people put core values at the center of their career and their life decisions. I'd like to ask you to talk about a specific experience or a memory from childhood or young adult years that really helped shape your values.
I have a few, and I'll share one from my father that I think really speaks to something that motivated a scene that I wrote in All American Boys, and also I think speaks to the core of who I hope I can become if I haven't already started down that road. And I remember a New Year's Eve when my parents and our family and a number of other families were all spending New Year's Eve together. And people had kind of saved up and decided they were going to have a hotel party. And so a number of families got hotel rooms side by side at a hotel in Boston. And we were all going to, hang out together. The parents were partying in one room, and the kids of various ages were in another room. And the kids were going to watch the movie Die Hard, which with Bruce Willis. And I was excited. I was really excited to watch this movie. And my father came in and said, you can't watch this. This movie is too violent for you. And I want to put myself in maybe fourth grade. So 9 years old, maybe I was 10 years old. But he said, this is too violent. You can't watch this movie. And all the other parents at the party were giving him a hard time, saying, oh, come on, it's New Year's. Like, what's the big deal? It's just, it's just a movie, and all the other kids were going to watch the movie. And so my dad pulled me out And I had to play Nerf basketball on my own in the hallway for a while. And then my father came back out of the adult party and took me downstairs to the lobby. And I'll never forget sitting on the on a little couch in the lobby of the hotel with him as he explained to me, what's the point of having principles if you don't stick to them? And to see, and you know, and I was broken up about it, and I was so upset in the moment. But I still look back at that always with a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, a sense of grounding. That if you do believe in something, you have to stick up for it and fight for it and stand by it. And I'll forever be grateful for my father for teaching me that lesson, because though it's so simple in the moment, we can, again, using the ripple effect, step out of that moment and begin to think about, well, if I really have problems with the racial injustice in our educational system, I can't just stand by and shrug my shoulders and say, well, you know, it's out of my hands, or this is, you know, it's, I'll let it slide this time. No, I have to be somebody who can stand up in that room and say, why are there more than 75% of the people who are authors in the curriculum in our county white? Why aren't we doing a better job promoting voices of color in our curriculum? I have to do that in the same way that my father stood up to his friends to say, just because you're going to let your kids watch this movie doesn't mean that I have to, too.
Yeah, and that I appreciate you drawing that full circle, not only kind of how the mindset first developed, your father talking about principles when you were young, but also then what it means today as an adult. It's also reassuring as a parent to hear that those kinds of experiences can really have a positive impact. I think sometimes children, when you know they're treated differently in their home than their friends are treated, feel that it's so unfair, and it can, you know, sometimes I guess be sort of a memory that doesn't always have a positive outcome. But in this case, your father was really showing you that principles have to be lived according to. So that's a great, great story. I'm also wondering, I always like to ask people if religion or spirituality has played a role in identifying core values. Again, whether as a child or now in this adult phase of your life.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, because I grapple with the distinctions between religion and spirituality, and I grew up in an Irish Catholic, large Irish Catholic family. Both my mother and father come from Irish Catholic backgrounds. Though both of them have incredibly conflicted feelings about the Catholic Church. My brother and I were, we joked that we were raised culturally Catholic, because we didn't really ever attend any mass or anything like that, but we did go to Catholic schools. We were around Catholicism, and I have to imagine that in many ways it's influenced my life. I also wonder sometimes, though, if we have a label like Catholicism that's so large, but the values that you're taught in one parish versus another are so vastly different, it's hard for me to square those two kinds of Catholicism. I think, for example, about the kinds of folks who are even in my family who are so vehemently anti-abortion, and I wonder about how that guiding principle for their lives was really taught to them from the same text that I studied, in Catholic school. That I don't, and it's a value that seems so foreign to me and so antithetical to the kind of compassion and care that I feel like I learned taking a Catholic sensibility social justice class, or working with the Zavarian brothers that I had as mentors when I was growing up. So that's why I have a complicated feeling about this, because I have larger issues and problems with the institution of Catholicism, and there's no way I could ever call myself a Catholic, and there's no way that I would want to raise my children so either. The spirituality question that you bring up, though, is interesting to me, because I think in particular, in a country like America, as opposed to, say, a predominantly Catholic country like Spain or Italy, we have a flexible understanding of spirituality that that I find fascinating. And in fact, I found fascinating even as a young person, because I was highly disillusioned with Catholicism when I was a teenager, and I was grateful that my school actually offered it. We had to take religion class every semester, and one of the electives was world religions. And I became fascinated by the possibility of an interconnectedness between religions around the world, so much so that it became the driving focus of what I studied as an undergraduate as well. My my major was essentially images of heroism in cross-cultural mythology, and my pursuit was I desperately wanted to believe that somewhere at the core, whether you were a Hindu or a Catholic or a Buddhist or a Muslim or a Jew or whatever it might be, that you would find some sense of shared value at the base of all that. I'm not sure I still agree with that, but that was my sensibility of purpose when I was studying that. And I have to believe that there is some spirituality that that I'm desperately trying to tap into that's connected with these sense of core values, because in some sense, I think what I'm hoping for and what I'm striving for is some sense that we're spiritually equitable on some base level. So why can't the expression of that spirit, i.e. our material life, also be equitable? Why does it have to be so unjust and imbalanced if somewhere at the core there's a spiritual equity at the bottom of it all? I haven't put any of this into words coherently.
No, I like
I just appreciate your question bringing it up, because it's I for one don't spend enough time thinking about it, and I'm grateful that you are someone who asks folks to take the time to think about it.
Well, I ask because I think for so many people religion has been a part of their upbringing, whether from their point of view positively or negatively. Religion, like philosophy, asks a lot of the great questions in life. And many religions do have a strong social justice focus, although I think you can also argue that religions are often operating to divide people as much as they are to bringing people together. But as you mentioned, religion has this cultural component. And I think for anyone who's been raised in a family, whether immediate or extended family, that has a strong religious identification, it's important to have some kind of religious literacy. It's important to at least have some sort of exposure. I know within my own family, my children are exposed to Christianity because it's such a part of our family background. At the same time, you know, you hope that they are free thinkers and that they can make decisions for themselves, which is not how I was raised. I was told what to think. But I think, you know, maybe you as well, trying to broaden your worldview, sounds like.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. I mean, my parents were very open-minded and supportive of pursuing other ideas. I wouldn't say that my parents imposed a how-to-think kind of philosophy, but they came from a community, and we lived within the community, and they came from a family that certainly did have those impositions, for sure.
I want to thank you, our listeners, for tuning into Your True North. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Your True North Podcasts.